are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right on Radio, I talk with Colin Dickey, author of The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. Colin looks at what all fringe beliefs have in common, explaining that today's Illuminati is yesterday's flat earth, the attempt to find the meaning in a world stripped of wonder.
And I'm Liz Olds. In the last part of our show, Annie speaks with poet and novelist Quan Berry about her latest novel, We Ride Upon Styx. We Ride Upon Styx follows the 1989 Danvers High School Falcons field hockey team, who will do anything to make it to the state finals, even if it means tapping into some devilishly dark powers. All of this and more. So stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Shake that stuff, and I can't deny that stuff, and I think that is such an important element to what drives these beliefs, and something that, you know, I hope comes across in the book, just my love and my recognition for that same kind of wonder and curiousness.
Yeah. I've had many experiences online where people I know have shared a quote of wisdom from some well-known revered person where I think a quick fact check would determine that there's no documented evidence that they ever said this line or this quote. It's very easy, I think, in this world of social media for us to inject our ideas under the guise of someone who people regard as having some authority on the topic. And I think this is an easy way for people to put their ideas out there. And it's a popular way for false rumors to start spreading very easily.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I mean, well, right. You know, because certainly, you know, I grew up before the internet age, and in retrospect, you know, a lot of things got spread that way because nobody had the means in their pocket to verify stuff. So somebody would tell you something, you sounded cool and weird, and you had no reason not to believe it. And I, you know, there was, you know, whole parcel of facts that I remember used to, you know, tell people at a drop of a hat at a party because I, you know, sounded cool, and people would think, wow, that's amazing. And then later I was like, oh, it turns out that's completely fictional. I don't know where that came from. So, you know, I mean, yeah, it's I think it's a facet of human nature. I think that just because we have like phones in our pockets now doesn't mean that that desire for that, you know, weird, strange, or, you know, noteworthy thing is going to disappear. And I try and be kind of, you know, a little bit charitable towards that, because I know that's just who we are. And, you know, so
we've had there's a resurgence of fringe beliefs that, despite having more tools and resources than ever before to find facts and more options for finding opinions from experts in any given field, this age, I think, proves that despite all the information that's provided to us, there's also more means of dismissing those facts when we don't want to hear them. And it also gives us the ability to obfuscate that truth when it doesn't suit our own beliefs. Is that part of the problem that we experience in this age of the internet?
Yeah, I mean, the more that I've looked at conspiracy theories, you know, I think when I first started, I thought, you know, the way to deal with this stuff is just to give somebody the facts, give somebody the evidence. So, you know, whatever they believe is wrong, but if you show them the truth, that'll set them straight. And it turns out that doesn't work hardly ever at all. You know, and as I've just sort of delved into it, I, you know, the conclusion that I've come to is that it's not that people are objectively looking for the facts and the truth, and so if you set them straight, they'll think, oh, I was wrong, and now I'm right. I think instead that a lot of these things are motivated by much more primal and central beliefs, and those beliefs color our abilities to process and sort of admit factual evidence, particularly when it runs counter to our belief system. So like, there's a famous story that I wrote about in the book, the story of Dorothy Martin in Oak Park, Illinois in 1955. So Dorothy Martin is a housewife who begins receiving messages from an alien, a Venusian from the planet Venus, who tells her that the world is going to flood on December 21st, 1955, and a spaceship is going to come down beforehand and pick up her and her devoted followers and take them to safety. Right. Mm-hmm. So she gathers this cult in her house, basically waiting for December 21st. And unbeknownst to her, one of the people in her cult is actually a sociologist who has infiltrated the group so he can write about it. And this guy is named Leon Festinger. And in the book he writes about it, he coins the phrase, which we still use, which is cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. So what happens is, okay, so Dorothy Martin, December 21st comes, and I don't know if you've heard, but the world did not end on December 21st, 1955, nor did a spaceship arrive in the middle of suburban Illinois to take these people up to Venus, right? And so what Festinger saw was that, some people in the group after that event failed to happen, you know, they gave up. They said, well, I guess we were wrong. I'm going to go back to my, my 9-to-5 job and move on with my life. But other members of the group, including Dorothy Martin, really doubled down. And they were like, you know, well, we got the date wrong, or, you know, we got some part of the message wrong, but the core is still there. You know, we're going to stick by this. And so Festinger's conclusion, and, you know, what the term cognitive dissonance sort of refers to, is when our belief system is out of line with the facts presented before us. Some people will alter their belief system. They'll say, okay, I was wrong. I need to sort of, adapt my belief system to the facts as I now understand them. But other people will start to discount the facts, that the belief system is so crucial to their identity and so crucial to who they are that they are willing to selectively ignore certain facts and or, you know, completely dismiss the evidence before them out of hand. And so where I think we're at with conspiracy theories right now is that for a good segment of the population, it simply does not work to correct them by just offering facts. And what you have to do instead is make an attempt to understand the belief system that is driving the conspiracy theory and try and understand what's motivating that belief system. And if you can't get to that belief system and unpack it, then it's going to be a lot harder to convince them that the facts are on your side.
You have a line early in your book where you talk about how ever since there's been a scientific establishment, there's always been distrust with that establishment. Is that partly the reason why? Is that there's this level of cognitive dissonance where you assault a person's belief system and they're so entrenched in this idea of who they are and how they believe themselves that they just actively resist this newfound knowledge that they're being confronted with?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, and again, this is a very obvious example, but you can look at the fight over evolution, right? You know, I mean, like, evolutionary theory comes along and it's solid science, but it conflicts with people's beliefs, you know, a certain segment of the population's belief system. And, you know, many of us were able to, you know, I guess many of us living in the 1840s at the time were able to say, oh, now we know more. We were wrong about that thing, but this is cool. Let's go forward with this newfound information. And there are other people who were basically like, no, you know, my belief system is paramount. Ergo, I'm going to discount the scientific reality before me. And so, yeah, so, you know, in the 19th century is really when you get science kind of, you know, solidifying into a discipline, as in, you know, it's no longer just a kind of, you know, well-to-do guy in his study with a microscope making, you know, amazing new discoveries. It's now, you know, people in institutions, people at universities, people with, you know, grant funding. And so it sort of shifts into this kind of institutional kind of role at the same time that it is actively challenging in many ways people's belief systems, and it sort of sets up an inevitable conflict where people decide that it is better to distrust the scientific establishment than to rework fundamental beliefs about the world.
A key difference you talk about is with science versus fringe believers is that whether the narrative for conspiracy thinking is always ever expanding, it's endless work, and it's adding to a central simplified claim, while science experiences roadblocks. You're examining the minute details, and you're constantly deliberately studying something for long stretches. And that's why I think fringe beliefs can catch on so quickly, where it's constantly always kind of latching on to new stuff, and it can just adapt to it, whereas science is a bit more objective and trying to have an objective base and trying to build its understanding of the world.
Yeah, and exactly. And I think what we're living through right now is a very good example of that. I think when this coronavirus epidemic first broke out, there was legitimately a lot of confusion. There was a lot of uncertainty. There was a lot of misinformation. There were a lot of things that we just didn't know. And there were a lot of times when the scientific establishment, you know, was working round the clock to figure out what was going on, but they had to keep saying, look, we don't know. We don't know exactly, how it moves. We don't know we don't know what the best way to prevent it is. We don't know what drugs are and aren't going to work. We're doing our best, but you have to give us time because this takes time. And again, you know, a good segment of the population heard that message and understood and said, okay, we will, suspend judgment and try and, you know, do our best while we wait for you guys to tell us the best way forward. But it opened up a space for a lot of conspiracy theorists and grifters to launch in and basically offer very straightforward, simplistic readings of the world that seemed with like one sort of fell swoop to wipe away all of the chaos and uncertainty and randomness and replace them with a simple and direct understanding of the world. And that was reassuring for a lot of the population, and thus you saw the way these grifters and con people and conspiracy theorists were able to monopolize a lot of the dialogue around this pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, fringe ideas, they're seductive in their simplicity. They're easy to grasp and understand and make it more susceptible for an average person who doesn't really know enough about it to believe in it, versus a long, drawn-out answer that a person can't fully comprehend. It makes it easier for a person to latch on to different fringe ideas. I think that's a scary but very honest observation. You make excellent observation about the people with conspiracy thinking beliefs we already talked about that point. Sorry, I'm going over my notes here. The rise of fringe beliefs, they began with the divorcing of religion and science. And I think it's interesting what it says about people. Even confronted with this disenchantment of the world, we still cling on possibilities that are larger than life, that attempts to bring order to the natural world. Did you have any findings in psychology or neuroscience that support why people choose to ignore the evidence?
Yeah, I mean, there's various theories about this. I mean, you know, there's a study that I think is quite useful in this regard, and that is, this was maybe about 10 years ago, this study came out, was basically you show people two images with a bunch of sort of static lines drawn all over the place. So, you know, like it's sort of like visual noise. And one of those images is nothing but the visual noise. And the other one has some sort of image behind the visual noise, some sort of simple drawing of like a hat or something. But it's, you know, it's sort of covered over by this visual noise. And you show them to people and you basically say, okay, do you see the hat? And they look and they see the hat and they say, okay, I see the hat. And then you show the other one, this pure visual image, and you say, you know, do you see anything there? And some people will say, no, I don't see anything. And other people say, yes, I see a car, I see a horse, I see whatever, I see my grandmother, you know, like whatever. And then they do a sort of psychological profile of people. And it turns out that the people who see...
Hi, everyone. everyone. Welcome back to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis-St. Paul and streaming live on KFAI.org. I'm Annie, and tonight we are joined by the amazing Quan Berry. She is a poet and a novelist. She's a Penn Award winner, and she is faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Quan, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Do you want to start us off today with a little reading from your latest novel, We Ride Upon Sticks?
Sure, I'd love to. So this excerpt I'm going to read actually introduces you to the 11 characters of the Danvers varsity women's field hockey team. And it opens with them at a pep rally, the fall pep rally. And the only things that you need to know for it, you'll hear a reference to two people named Bert and Ernie. And so Bert and Ernie are the two police officers who were assigned to work the school beat. And students refer to them as Bert and Ernie because one has a unibrow and there's a large difference in their heights. So you will hear a reference to them. But again, this is what happens at the annual fall pep rally. Then Principal Yoff was standing at the microphone trying to get the student body to shut up. When it finally quieted down, he said a bunch of stuff about Falcon spirit, the trophy case outside the main office, the exceptionalism of Danvers High's young men and women, blah, blah, blah. We always wondered if Principal Yoff even liked pep rallies. The guy had a PhD in education from Wisconsin. Did he feel like a tool standing up there in front of the student body yammering on about winning? We felt embarrassed for him when he concluded his speech with his fist in the air and a weak noise that we gathered from context was supposed to be some sort of rebel yell. Bert and Ernie were standing off to the side in their police uniforms. They nodded approvingly at the strange yodeling emanating out of Principal Yoff. We didn't even know why they were there. To show school spirit? But it was probably part of some new initiative to convince us kids the cops were our friends, the thinking being if we viewed them as allies today, tomorrow we'd be more likely to run to them, narking on our friends when something serious went down. From there, the rally was pretty unremarkable until the hoop appeared. Karen Burrows and the cheerleaders had just gotten it positioned in place, a big blue falcon painted right in the middle of it, when Jen Fiorenza turned to us and screamed, "Field, field, field! Hockey, hockey, hockey," we yelled. And before any of us knew what was happening, we were charging the hoop, a herd of water buffalo stampeding on the African plain, Principal Yoff a casualty of our herd mentality, the guy buffeted every which way as we whirred past. Jen was the first through, her claw a rhino horn, the paper tearing, each of us as if we were being born again, only to reemerge in a whole new world, all 11 of us pouring through. Abby Putnam, a ray of light. Girl Corey, a woman scorned. Mel Boucher with the dark mark on her neck. Boy Corey hoping nobody was looking at him. Becca Bajelica wondering why she hadn't worn a third bra. Sue Yoon with her hair dyed Kool-Aid Incrediberry. A.J. Johnson wondering who among us really had her back. Heather Houston following blindly without her glasses. Julie Kaling like a monarch butterfly on its way to Mexico. Little Smitty gnashing badly at the paper with her teeth. Be aggressive. Be aggressive. The other fall sports falling in line behind us. Football bringing up the rear. The marching band blowing their brains out. The cheerleaders screaming along to the Budweiser theme. When you say DHS, you've said it all. Thanks.
Oh, there's so much to unpack there and so much to love. But I just want to start out by saying I was compelled by your choice to write the book in the plural third person, we, without it being tagged to a specific character, as if the book had been written by like an unnamed teammate friend or maybe even by the team's collective mind. I think this really set the tone of the book and its energy. How did you come to the decision to do that? And how did it feel to craft text like that?
So it's true that the we voice, the first person plural, is not a voice, a number that you often see in fiction.
Yes.
So some of the more famous examples of that, or one of the more famous examples, is Jeffrey Eugenides' The Virgin Suicides. So in that book, it's a group of teen boys who live in a neighborhood, and they're basically watching a family of girls. And so we get the we voice of the boys watching this family. And so when I started to write the book, I always knew that I wanted to write it in a first person plural voice. I just wasn't sure who the voice was going to belong to, like who the we was going to be. So when I first started off, at first I thought maybe it was the entire school, that like maybe this whole school was watching this varsity team of women who play field hockey. But it was just a little bit too unwieldy when I first started. And then I thought, well, maybe the we voice will belong to the freshman team. So oftentimes when it comes to sports, you know, you usually have a freshman team, you have a junior varsity team, and then you have a varsity team. And I thought, well, maybe it's the freshman team. There's a way in which younger classmen oftentimes idealize, like, the senior girls. It was definitely true when I was playing field hockey. So I thought, well, maybe it's the freshman team. And they're watching the seniors, and they're just really, you know, just they just idolize them. But when I started doing that, I had a hard time because I couldn't quite justify why these freshman girls would have been in certain spaces or why they would have known certain things. And so I realized that that voice didn't work. And then after that, I realized pretty quickly then that the voice actually just belonged to the team collectively. And that in doing that, it allowed me a couple of things. So one thing, I always like to joke that there's no I in team, right? So teams are supposed to be collective. So it kind of makes sense that it would be the team telling their own story.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that it allowed me to do is because the book does have elements of witchcraft in it, it allowed me to bring in an element of magical realism by having it be this collective voice that tells the story. And so it made sense then, too, that the team over time begins to develop a collective hive mentality as well, which just adds to the overall witchiness of the book.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic answer. And that actually makes me think of... do you mind if I ask about the kind of the what gets called the internal line on the team? Because I love the way that though throughout the book the various witchy happenings sometimes they get called into question and sometimes they get proven to actually just be one of the girls on the team being really extraordinary. But the girls on the team do communicate telepathically through the story on what they refer to as the internal line. For those of you who haven't read the book yet. And I was wondering, did you have a worldly explanation for that? Or is it just the magical realism of a bunch of women finding their strength?
So to me, it's and both. So it's both things, right?
Yeah.
So I almost think of it in terms of even just like the witchy aspects in general. I almost think of it as in terms of like Dumbo. If you remember in Dumbo, he has that like magical feather that helps him to fly.
Uh-huh.
So it's really about confidence, right?
Yeah.
And so, but then he can also really fly too, right?
Yeah.
Which is magical. And
yeah.
So here I think of it in the same kind of thing. Like, so the question is like, is there some kind of supernatural connection between these people?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just kind of a sisterhood? The way that women oftentimes do form really close bonds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oftentimes like, for example, it's not unusual for sisters, even for good friends, to be able to finish each other's sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not suggesting that that's like a gendered thing, but we usually don't think of men as having that same kind of closeness, you know, among friendships the way that women do, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so to me, it is. It's that, well, is it a little bit of this or is it a little bit of that? And so I was definitely trying to have it both ways, the idea that like, okay, maybe there is something supernatural going on here. And at the same time, maybe it's just the idea of just the closeness of girls, particularly teen girls, and what that can result in.
Yeah. Continuing on that strong female energy, the writing throughout the book has this largely youthful humor that I like really was drawn into and found very lively. And it kept me reading this book on the bus and at the stove while I'm cooking, just all over the place. And the humor itself, I noticed that it was often built on physical and visual comedy, but it's never like, it's not usually like violent comedy, someone slipping on a banana peel. It was always these really smart, well-crafted observations about odd things in the world. And I found that played in really prominently to the kind of magical realism you hinted at earlier. And I was just wondering if you had either your own ideas or... inspiration from other writers and artists in terms of how you created the particular magical realism in the Danvers of your novel.
Mm-hmm. So going back to just the idea of humor, so I won't address the magical realism just yet, but just as far as how I thought about humor working in this book and what I was trying to do.
Yes.
So I didn't look at too many, so I can't say that I did a lot of research in it, but I did look at a few novels written by women for women that are considered to be humorous. So I don't want to throw any under the bus, but kind of like in the vein, for example, of Bridget Jones' Diary.
Yeah.
So if you remember those books,
again,
they're, I don't know, 15 years old, 20 years old. And again, I have to admit, I'm not throwing Bridget Jones' Diary under the bus. But a lot of those kinds of books, I noticed that the humor in them was what I call quote unquote situational, right?
Yes.
It was the humor of like, oh my God, I'm going on a first date and I've ripped my dress, or oh my God, I've burned the roast, or whatever. It was that kind of humor, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it is kind of a little bit like the slipping on the banana peel kind of humor.
Yeah.
And the kind of humor that I'm interested in is humor that's actually baked in at the level of the sentence.
Right. Yes.
It's actually done through description.
Yeah.
And those kinds of things. I find that kind of humor to be more interesting, to be more cerebral, and to be more satisfying.
Yeah.
So somebody that I'm a big fan of. A lot of Americans don't read him anymore, but he's a master to me. British author who, admittedly, maybe is not the world's most PC person, but is Martin Amis.
Oh, yeah.
So Martin Amis. British novelist whose father was Kingsley Amis, who was Poet Laureate of England.
Yep.
Martin Amis, particularly in his essays, he doesn't write many essays, but he does have a couple books of essays. He's also a novelist primarily.
Uh-huh.
But he has a way of describing things, and it's in the actual description is where the humor is. So
yeah.
I'm going to totally blow this description, but for example, in one of his political essays, and if you've never read him, you should read his political essays because they're just so astute and so funny.
Sounds good.
But he has a description of Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, in one of his essays.
Uh-huh.
And he basically describes Mitt Romney, and again, I'm paraphrasing, quote-unquote, I shouldn't say quote-unquote, but he paraphrases, he says that Mitt Romney always has the pained expression of a man with a sore shoulder who's just shrugged his way into a too-tight dinner jacket. You know? It's like, but nice. He always has that pain expression. I'm like, he does. He does look like a dude with a sore shoulder who just shrugged his way into a too tight dinner jacket, right? And so to me, like, the humor is in the description of that.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's not just in the fact that Mitt Romney always looks pained.
Yeah.
It's in, like, how, it's like the precision of how he describes that.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I was very much thinking about in writing this book. So I'm interested in that kind of humor and not in the, oh, I slipped on a banana peel kind of thing, which has its place at times too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I can like that kind of thing as well. But to me, it's the actual literary descriptions that I think are most effective. And again, can you remind me the second half about magical realism or...
I was just wondering if in terms of magical realism, especially funny magical realism, kind of how you decided on both the level of magic that was going to be going on in Danvers and also if you had any inspirations or if you just set your own parameters and ran with them.
I think of the magic in the book as being really DIY in a way in which I think girls in the 1980s would have been DIY, right? So it's before the internet.
Yeah.
Like, they can't just look stuff up and find out how to do stuff.
Yeah.
As kids, and I'm sure I wasn't the only one with my friends who was doing it, you know, you would try and do little, like, magical things where you try and lift somebody using only your fingers, being like, light as a feather, stiff as a board.
Yeah.
Or, you know, there are ways in which you might stand in front of a mirror and say, you know, it's mostly just to creep yourself out, like, at a slumber party.
Yeah.
And so I thought of a lot of the kinds of things that they would be doing is being like that. Like, they're just trying to figure this out, whatever works for them. They don't really have any set ways of casting spells or what have you.
Yeah.
It's true that they eventually, you know, they go to Salem and they maybe find a book and then, you know, it kind of pumps up what they're up to. But it was a really sort of DIY thing.
Yeah.
And then I also, because I am interested in magical realism in my fiction, and the way I try and use it is that you can only really have... At the end of the day, you can only really have, like, one magical element. If you have too many, then the reader just doesn't buy it anymore. So, for example, like, we've all seen those movies where, you know, somebody gets into trouble, and then all of a sudden, like, there's a magical door in the wall that they can just walk through, and then it's over. You're like, well, you know, it lets go of the tension, and then it just seems like anything can happen, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, to me, the major magical element was just going to be in communication and how they can communicate and things like that. So I tried to limit myself. There might be a couple of other things that happen in the book, but I tried to limit myself just to that one magical element.
Cool. Great. So for anyone who's just joining us, we're in conversation with Quan Berry, author of We Ride Upon Sticks on KFAI 90.3 FM. Getting back into the book, Quan, the story lays down some underpinning, just like lightly throughout the book, in the origin of witchcraft and the way witchcraft, a lot of elements of it stem from African and African-American culture. Including a moment I really loved in which A.J. Johnson's mom kind of explicitly points out to the reader that the powerful armbands that all of the girls on the field hockey team wear together to keep their magic with them are also a tradition in parts of Africa, which it is unclear if the girls on the team know that or not. What was your research project like in learning about witchcraft history worldwide? And would you say it's similar or different to that of the Danvers team? I know you probably had a search engine to use and they didn't, but tell me about your witchcraft story.
Mm-hmm. So I myself, I'm fortunate to have traveled quite a bit in the world, and I've actually, I was in West Africa a few summers ago, and I observed firsthand how people, I don't know if they would necessarily use the word witchcraft, but ways in which items that have been imbued with magical qualities are an important part of some people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so I saw that firsthand,
cool.
You know, this idea of these traditions continuing. Mm-hmm. And I know, too, that some of those things still hold in places in the South. I don't want to say just the South, but there are certain places, again, in Black communities, mm-hmm. Where people still turn to traditional healings, traditional methods of staying safe and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was interested in that. You know, the things that you point out are definitely in the book, but it's true, like those, I feel like those are the only two mentions.
Yeah.
You just happen to pick up on both of them in certain kinds of ways.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the idea of research, I myself grew up in the town of Danvers.
Yeah.
And Danvers back in 1692 was actually part of Salem.
Mm-hmm.
It was a part called Salem Village.
Yeah.
And that's actually where the first sort of events happened that then spurred on the Salem witch trials.
Mm-hmm.
And so growing up in the town of Danvers, I was always familiar with what happened in 1692 because, you know, I grew up less than a mile away from some of the happenings,
mm-hmm.
Some of the places where those things happened. So I have to admit, I just always kind of, it was always, you know, in fifth grade, you take a class field trip where you go to various sites. It was always something that we studied. It was just something that I always knew as far as the history
mm-hmm.
of witchcraft in Massachusetts. I have to admit that I don't know necessarily as much about the history of witchcraft in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that, again, thousands of people in Europe were killed, including men, but mostly women.
Yeah.
And the things that I do know about the history of witchcraft in Europe is that, to me, witchcraft aligns very closely with the idea of female empowerment.
Yeah.
And that's always been true, I think, throughout the ages. So, you know, many of the women who were hung or who were killed in Europe, they were women who didn't conform in certain kinds of ways, women who weren't typically feminine. Either they were too old, maybe they were too independent, maybe they weren't mothers, maybe they weren't married. You know, there were always mm-hmm. ways in which it was women who were outliers, who, again, weren't conforming societally, were the ones who were oftentimes singled out as witches.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also true in Salem Village in 1692.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first women who was actually hung was a woman named Bridget Bishop. My understanding of her at the time is that she was a tavern owner, which, you know, for a woman to own her own tavern, and that secondly, it was said that she liked to wear red, you know, and that was something that was kind of held against her.
Uh-huh.
And so I was really, so, you know, as far as the amount of research I did, I again, with respect to Danvers itself, I actually have a lot of knowledge about Danvers since I grew up there.
Yes.
But it was important to me to incorporate actual historical facts into the book.
Yeah.
So you get the names of all the people who were hung. You mm-hmm. know, you find out things about them. You find out things about Tituba, who was the enslaved woman who lived in the home of the Reverend Samuel Parris. And
yeah.
his homestead is where many of the girls were spending time who eventually accused people.
Mm-hmm.
So it was important to me to work in, like I said, those historical moments.
Yeah. So I noticed also that a strong undercurrent of the book is the girls on the team not only discovering, like, kind of discovering witchcraft, but largely discovering themselves and their very different mm-hmm. identities long before things like body positivity or queer acceptance or Black girl magic or Black Lives Matter or intersectional feminism. But I found all of those ideas to be present in the book without being named as explicitly. How did it feel writing about these issues in an 80s context while you're sitting in 2020? And it kind of feels like women have, at least from my end reading the book, it kind of felt like women had come so far, but it also felt like very little had changed.
I was really interested because I think nowadays, particularly with maybe younger generations or maybe even my own generation,
yeah.
it's easy to think about the 80s. Oh, the 80s, you know, and they had those funny outfits they wore. The hair was crazy and the music is pretty good still, but other things yeah. that maybe haven't aged so well.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to just look back on it kind of just 100% nostalgically rather yeah. than critically, right?
Yeah.
But it's true. If you go back and you look at a lot of the cultural things that were circulating, a lot of that was just unhealthy stuff that we just took for granted. I recently, actually in the last year, I rewatched Purple Rain, you know, Princess Purple Rain.
Yeah.
And it's true that while the music really stands, I mean, the music is still amazing, like the club scenes is still amazing, but, you know, in quite a few scenes, like, he hits his girlfriend quite a bit. And I don't remember at the time anybody criticizing that. Like, wow, why is this character hitting his girlfriend repeatedly?
Yeah.
And so I was super interested. I knew if I was going to write about the 80s, I couldn't just write about that part of the 80s. I had to write about all of the 80s, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the 80s, it's post-Reagan. It's, you know, the AIDS crisis is really ramping up, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. You know, the Central Park Five happened. There's just a lot of things happening. And I felt like it would have been irresponsible of me just to present the 80s again through that rose-tinted, big-haired lens. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I was interested in, you know, in looking at the 80s with a more critical eye, mm-hmm. while still having fun with it.
Yeah.
And so I actually found it really satisfying to rethink that time period, but to complicate it, right? So it's cool. Not a John Hughes movie where everything works out in the end necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what are the ways in which it was complicated? What are the ways in which, you know, if you don't have a language for who you are, if there isn't a language for Black girl magic, or if there isn't a language for LGBTQ people, like, how do you form your self-identity? And so I was super interested in thinking about those kinds of things, and I found it very satisfying to reconsider all that stuff.
Cool. Yeah, I that was another thing that I just loved about the book, and that hit home in a powerful way while still being part of a reading experience that was, for the most part, super fun and relatively light. Just to ask one last question, since we're running out of time. I don't want to spoil anything for readers who haven't finished the book yet or might pick it up from the store. I did like the way you got good mileage out of having an epilogue-style section that reveals some logical but still surprising things about the Danvers teammates as adults in like our time. Did you write the book with the characters' adulthoods in mind, or did you find everyone as you went along the story?
Yeah, I'm the kind of writer, I plan nothing.
Uh-huh.
I think it's also a reason why I like magical realism, is it because it throws, like, an X unexpected factor into things.
Cool.
I'm somebody who, like, I like to write my way into a corner, and then mm-hmm. I have to figure out how to get out of that. So
yeah.
I didn't know until we were getting pretty, pretty close to the end how, what was going to happen, or where we were going to end up, or what have you.
Yeah.
And I think Robert Frost, the poet, very famously, poets are always quoting this, Robert Frost very famously said, you know, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
Oh,
and
yeah.
What he means by that is, like, if you have a deterministic idea right from the get-go of what you're going to do, it's going to feel fairly formulaic in mm-hmm. certain kinds of ways, right?
Yeah.
And so I think the same thing holds with fiction. So it was the idea that, like, you know, I knew what the general structure of the book was, that every chapter was a different game and a different character was featured.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I didn't really have any ideas. And so it's true, like, I oftentimes was surprised as I was writing it. And hopefully that element of surprise then also translates to surprises for the reader as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it totally felt, it felt very authentically surprising and engaging to me. Well, thank you so much for this great conversation. We have to wrap up right now, but I really appreciate you joining us tonight.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
have been listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Colin Dickey and Quan Berry, plus our listeners and listener members who make this show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our podcast. Now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.